Calories to the left. Calories to the right. Stand up, sit down, fright, fright, fright. Whatever. This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome back to Junk Food Cinema, Film School Rejects' weekly cult and exploitation appreciation podcast with plenty of fat, but 0 grams of irony. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, a graduate of Horror High, and I am joined by my friend and co-pilot through the nebulous of the nebulose, novelist slash screenwriter, C. Robert Cargill.
Hi, everybody.
And I want to remind you that Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes, and while you're there, why not give us a 5-star rating and leave a review? That'd be super nice of you. We're also available on Stitcher for those of you who are not using the iTunes. And we are on Twitter. You can follow us at Junk Food Cinema. You can also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And please do use the Amazon links. Everything we talk about will have an Amazon link right here at the bottom of the page in case you'd like to pick it up. Well, welcome to what I have dubbed for this week, Outside the Actor's Studio. We're going to be discussing some very early and very forgotten films for a prominent Hollywood leading man. Films that James Lipton would surely omit from his tower of index cards.
You say a prominent Hollywood type, a guy who's on his way to being a Hollywood legend, who has been working in the industry for 30 years and has done it in a number of capacities and is truly one of our great talents and a really great inventive and wonderful humanitarian. A man who I believe is neck and neck with the leader of the Russian free world for most interesting man in the world. I think it's between Clooney and Putin, and Clooney kind of by a nose, because Clooney doesn't invent all the cool things that all the weird photo shoots that Putin does. But Clooney, George Clooney, the Cloonster, El Cloonerino to his friends. Is really this amazingly talented guy with a whole wonderful body of work that was a struggling young good-looking actor in the 80s who did exactly what struggling young good-looking actors in the 80s do.
Porn. No. Actually not porn.
Slasher films and oddball comedies.
Yeah, we're not here to talk about his appearances in shows like Riptide and Street Hawk, nor even his very memorable turn as Ace on the show ER. No, instead we're going to talk about movies like Return of the Killer Tomatoes.
The Return of the Killer Tomatoes.
As you remember, 10 years ago, mankind was threatened with the greatest red menace of all. Angry, merciless, Killer Tomatoes. Now, they're back.
This time, we shall not fail!
This is the very, very self-aware sequel to a very dopey horror flick.
To a super indie horror flick. I mean, it was a comedy to begin with. I mean, to call it a horror flick is a little extreme, since it was clearly a joke and a send up and a parody of its own right, but a very low budget one, followed up by a modestly budgeted sequel years later.
Not a budget anyone was getting rich off of, for sure. And you know, here's the great thing about Return of the Killer Tomatoes: I've never actually seen the original. I've seen the sequel probably 5 times. I don't think I've ever actually seen the original.
I've seen the original, and I watched the original only because I'd seen, you know, Return of the Killer Tomatoes so many times. The thing is that you can watch Return of the Killer Tomatoes with ever having seen Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, and you don't need to see Attack of the Killer Tomatoes because all the best jokes from Attack of the Killer Tomatoes are in Return of the Killer Tomatoes.
Yeah, it kind of pulls for a while the Silent Night, Deadly Night 2 thing, where it puts a good chunk of the first movie into the second movie. And in fact, the movie calls itself out for it, where someone like... So the film starts with a sort of late night cable access type host who is like, you know, we're going to watch this midnight movie and it's Return of the Killer Tomatoes and we're going to do this contest. If you know the secret word. So it's very much aware of, I think, the type of legacy it's going to have. It knows it's going to be a midnight movie from conception. And then from there, you get all these expositional scenes of what happened in Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. And then you hear somebody call into that show and go, wait, I thought I was watching a new movie. This seems like you're just recycling all this old footage. And then he just hangs up on her. So it's aware of itself to the point that even when it pulls shit like that, it calls itself on pulling shit like that.
The Return of the Killer Tomatoes. Guess what? It's a lot better. It had to be.
You know, the thing about Return of the Killer Tomatoes is it's actually a really, really clever comedy.
It is.
It's a very well-written comedy. It's got some gags in it. It's got one gag in particular, one scene that I think does one joke better than any other movie, even though several other big-budget movies have made the joke in the future. Another comedy would do it a handful of years later. We'll go into that in a little bit when we talk about this. But nobody quite did it as well as Return of the Killer Tomatoes. And part of what really works about Return of the Killer Tomatoes is it's your classic kind of bumbling protagonist falling in love with a girl he's not supposed to fall in love with, getting caught up in this big overarching, you know, plot. And he's got the sleazy best friend, which was a staple of the 80s. And there was, until this point, there was no sleazy best friend better than Willie Ames. And Willie Ames, you know, of course, from Charles in Charge and Zapped, where he was Scott Baio's wingman, who was, you know, Scott Baio was the straight man and Willie Ames was, you know, the zany sleazeball. And then George Clooney comes along and takes the title of greatest sleazeball buddy ever. He plays this guy who pretends to be a Playboy talent scout just to get topless photos of women and to get them to go out on dates with him.
Oh, not only that, but he pitches the contest as win a date with Rob Lowe.
Yes.
It's like, win a date with Rob Lowe, and he's like, so what's going to happen when you pick a winner? And he's like, I'll just tell them that they have to settle for the second prize, which is me.
Yeah, he's really funny.
Yeah.
And that leads up to this great moment that pulls together both of these things that we just talked about, in which the director calls cut on the movie, and the movie stops. And the actors are like, wait, what's going on? And they're like, we've run out of money. We're out of money. We can't make the rest of Return of the Killer Tomatoes. And then Clooney goes on this bit where he's like, here's the problem, this generic beer. And all throughout the movie, everybody's been drinking generic stuff and eating generic stuff. And it was all very, very movie-ish. And
the labels look like what happens when you put on the glasses and they live. It's that kind of typeset. And everything just says beer or cornflakes or laundry detergent. Like, there's no brand names or logos visible.
Yeah. And so what he does is he's like, this isn't going to cut it. We need product placement. And he explains what product placement is to the audience. And then from that point on, the movie is choked with product placement. And the scene immediately after is George Clooney walking into a bar and having a conversation with a guy trying to get a beer and naming off beers and naming off, you know, I'm kind of hungry and, you
here's
know.
A candy bar. And you know. Nestle Crunch.
And then there's this huge fight scene where ninjas and cowboys wander in from out of nowhere, and you have these characters like slowly trying to move products into position in the background,
yeah.
And it's fucking hilarious.
There's a great scene right after they do this whole spiel about product placement where George Clooney and, by the way, the other actor, the other lead in this movie, Anthony Stark. But not Iron Man somehow.
No.
Anyway, so
different Tony Stark.
Different Tony Stark. So they're having this conversation, and literally somebody off screen just lifts up a box of cornflakes and puts it right between them. That's the thing about this movie, is really campy and weird as it is, it's got some legitimately laugh out loud moments.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's one of those things we talk about a lot, where a movie can be too aware of itself, like a little too in on the joke. And I feel like Return of the Killer Tomatoes is exactly at the right amount of in on the joke.
Well, the thing is that it goes past the point of breaking the fourth wall to the point that it gets funny again.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, it's so absurd. And then you have that moment later in the movie where George Clooney is on the, they're on the ATVs, and they're going to take the ATVs to the villain's house, which, by the way, now has a lit Pepsi sign in the window.
And the mad scientist villain is now wearing a lab coat with a Pepsi logo on the back.
Yeah, and they're like, hey, I'm really glad we have these ATVs from this place. And they start talking about how they're the sales leader. And just Clooney's like, guys, have we paid for this movie yet? And then you see all the producers hanging out with, you know, in a hot tub drinking champagne with, you know, women in bikinis. And they're like, yeah, whatever. Go make the movie. and it's so absurd. But they take that joke to the end. And then from that point on, then the movie is the big climax of the movie. And it's so silly. And it's so 80s.
Yeah.
Like everything, you know, the basic plot is about, it's John Astin, right?
Yes,
the mad scientist.
Mm-hmm.
Is cloning tomatoes, and he's changed the genetic code so that when you put them on this machine and play this music, they transform into whatever based on the song.
Yeah, they take on qualities based on what music you're playing, and he has this thing where he plays like really sort of generic sounding montage music from the 80s, and he gets like Rambo types.
Yes, yeah, and they're all these Rambo clones. They've got this great mutant tomato running around called Fuzzy Tomato, which is a parody of R2-D2 and all of the little cute cuddly things for kids that they put into movies. And they even play that. It's, Mom, I want a Fuzzy Tomato too. And the movie just really is a great send-up of everything that was going on in the 80s.
Yeah.
And George Clooney is the star of that fucking movie. He's not the protagonist, but everything that comes out of his mouth is fucking golden, and he's hilarious. And the George Clooney that would then be known as one of the most charming, funny guys in Hollywood, you're seeing the young him right there just fucking go all out, and he is fantastic.
And all of his feather-haired, slinky-headed glory.
He was a John Stamos clone at the time.
Yep, I mean, that's true.
At the time I remember seeing it, it's like, well, he's not John Stamos. But
never too young to be John Stamos, apparently. But I want to talk about John Astin for a second, playing this like mad scientist who turns tomatoes into people. At one point during the film, and I thought this was such a clever little in-joke, there's an ice cream truck that's just driving by. It's a very nothing scene, but if you listen, the ice cream truck is playing the Addams Family theme.
Yeah.
It's just a little snippet of it as it drives by, and if you aren't paying attention, you'll miss it, and it's such a great little joke. But there's a scene early on where one of the tomatoes turns into quite the tomato, you might say, this very sexy female, and the two our two heroes are at the house, and they're talking to her, and then they look over, and there's these three Rambo-type dudes, two of which are smashing potted plants, and the other one's like hammering a nail into wood, and they just look at her, and she's like, they are gardeners and carpenters and not transformed tomatoes. And it's just like the way she throws the line away, I love it so much. And then, of course, there's the fact that she's like, are you requiring breakfast or sex now? And it's just, yeah, I like this.
Yeah, she knows how to do two things. She knows how to make toast. She knows how to do some crazy sexual thing with a lawn chair, six milk bottles, and a tuning fork.
You wouldn't believe what she can do with six milk bottles and a tuning fork.
That's the other really 80s thing about the movie, is as dirty as it wants to be, it's still so PG about it.
Oh, yeah.
It's so PG about the way it approaches sex. Like the first time anyone in the movie says blowjob, the guy acts like he's never heard the word before, and it's just like, oh, wait, hey, what are you talking about? I don't...
This is the 80s, we haven't invented this yet.
Oh, hey, sort of still a family film, I guess, whatever. But yeah, and it's kind of this weird precursor to, like, the meta horror of the 90s and the Wes Craven stuff, except that it's not just meta about horror, it's meta about the entire... about the entire filmmaking process. I love that there's a scene where, you know, after they say that, you know, we've run out of money, what are we going to do? The local Screen Actors Guild representative comes in and is like, actually, all these people who are in the crew who are now on film, they're speaking, so you have to pay them. And he's like, everybody stop talking. And then they all at once go, okay. So
It's silly, and it's over the top, but it's silly and over the top in all the right ways. It is a goofy cult comedy that really does deliver and is really satisfying on multiple viewings.
Yeah.
It's one of those great 80s comedies that sadly doesn't get the attention that it deserves, like, you know, something like an Airplane, that I think is every bit as funny and has every bit the talent, both in front of the camera and behind.
And from there, we're going to kind of follow this pattern of diminishing Clooney's. Because of the three films we're talking about in this early horror repertoire of George Clooney, he is in these movies for, you know, increasingly less time.
Yeah.
The next of these, continuing along the sort of meta-horror vibe, From Return of the Killer Tomatoes, we are now returned to Horror High.
Yes.
Killer to the left! Killer to the right! Stand up! Sit down! Right, right, right!
Return to Horror High.
Horror High is a movie about a massacre that occurs on the set of a film, which is itself based on the true story of a serial killer massacre on the campus where they're filming. So it's, again, the serpent eating its tail type of meta. But it's not, in fact, a sequel. The return in the title refers to the fact that this film crew is coming back to this infamous school where something happened years before and making a movie about it.
And might be happening again.
Or it might not. It's a little, like, you could sit down and pay full and utmost attention to this film and still have a hard time tracking it, because not only do they play around so much with, no, this is part of the movie, no, this is really happening, but there's also dream sequences in there, and then people are dreaming about filming scenes that are actually part of the movie that seem real. So it's just like, it's the inception of weird 80s meta horror films. And George Clooney plays a security guard who I believe is in the movie for about 6.5 minutes.
Yeah.
And then,
although
he's gone.
The versions that you have access to in this day and age all say starring George Clooney.
Starring is a little bit of a dubious term here, I believe. But it is an interesting and fun take on nonstop splatter flicks, which we got a lot of in this period in the 80s, and especially those that were heavily influenced by giallo. So they all had this sort of like this persecuted or wronged person year later, 2 years later, whatever, kind of seeking their revenge in the bloodiest way possible, you know, something like A Prom Night or, you know, what have you, like all these movies where the plot was basically the same. It was somebody's been wronged, and then a year later they're getting their revenge, and it's really bloody, and it's just carnage candy for gore fans. And this was an interesting take on that, at least, and had a decent cast beyond Clooney. In fact, it has Maureen McCormick, who I think a lot of people might remember as Marsha Brady.
Or who even more people would remember from Skate Town USA.
If they had seen the glory that is Skate Town USA. Which more people need to. I'm just going to throw that out there. And that's something, that's another topic for another day. But definitely going to need to talk about that. But in addition to that, it also has a guy named Alex Rocco, who you may not recognize the name, but he's a guy that worked in so many movies, and most notably as Mo Green in The Godfather. I mean, this is a very, you know, a legendary, well-established actor who's playing this really shady director of this film. And you watch him manipulate cast members, and it's like, you didn't get your check? Oh, those bastards. I told him my crew is my family. I'm going to send it personally. And I walk away, and he's like, never fucking paying that guy. He's just, you know, he's every bit a caricature of, I don't want to say Roger Corman, but he's a caricature of, you know,
of Roger Corman.
Of Roger Corman.
Filmmaker. And there's the Corman alarm.
And there's the Corman alarm. Woohoo! It's been a while. I'm so glad that that still exists. But yeah, I mean, there are certain things to like about it. I really like the design of the killer. You got this sort of like druid robe and a plaster white face mask. Although I did keep waiting for the killer to remind our sexy heroes that the weapon systems would be quite operational when their friends arrived. But it does, I don't know, it's a fine movie. It's not crazy good, but it is really, it's sort of in the same way that Return of the Killer Tomatoes understands horror films. This one really does. Like, there's some great lines. There's one where the girl says to the guy, why does everyone want to go into dark basements without flashlights? And it's such a telling line. It's like, oh, that happens in every horror movie for no reason whatsoever. It's just like, oh, what is that, a noise? I'll go investigate.
You know, the thing I've always been taken with about this movie is this movie looks and feels like every 80s horror film kind of like idealized. Mm-hmm. Like they were, I don't know how much of it is just because it's a pastiche of so many of these films, because by the point they made this, you know, slasher films were, you know, a cottage industry and everyone was making them and they were making tons of them, and that you had people working on them so often that they could make them in their sleep, or how much of it was really self-aware and the fact that they were trying to evoke all of the tropes and everything about those movies of those time to kind of make the ultimate and final, you know, work on the matter. Like, this is everything about that. And it really does, you know, there's so many, you and I have just kicked back with, a six pack and drank watching these, you know, sometimes abysmal, you know, slasher films from this era. And if you were to draw it and put it in, you know, condense it into one film, Return to Horror High would really be that movie. It would really, it kind of says everything about that era.
And it's, that's the thing, is it's operating within this time frame where it's not only are slashers ubiquitous, but you've also had a big run on movies making fun of slashers. Like Student Bodies jumps to mind for me, a movie that is just so aware of this craze of slasher films that it just starts to mock them. And I feel like Return to Horror High is a movie that's not going for the easy jokes. It's not just pointing out. It's very much the difference between, you know, Abrams and Zucker and Freeburg and Seltzer. Freeburg and Seltzer can point to things and go, look, see, that's in those movies. Abrams and Zucker can take those things and find a way to make them fresh and find a way to cleverly underscore why they're in all these movies and use them in a way that kind of redirects the joke and makes it something of its own. And I feel like that's in a lot of ways what Return to Horror High does, is it's not just, hey, you ever notice how there's always a creepy janitor? Instead of just pointing out that there's a creepy janitor, because of the fact that they're making a movie, the janitor is always mopping up blood and nobody ever questions it because they're making a slasher film. So the creepy janitor is always mopping up blood and the joke is that no one ever cares.
Yeah.
Because of the nature of the structure of this film. So, and again, Clooney, not in it for a super long amount of time, but it is definitely worth noting because just basically because of what it the era that it represents. And again, it's just Clooney kind of working through these early struggling years and doing all of these horror films. But I will say this about Return to Horror High. He's in it for a lot longer than he is in the next film we're going to discuss. Yes. And I am so freaking excited to talk about this next film.
You've been wanting to talk about this one for a while.
I really have. Now, guys, we're going to talk about Grizzly 2.
In these woods, fresh air can be bad for your health.
We're going to talk about a movie that doesn't technically exist.
Now, some of you might be thinking to yourselves, I had no idea they made a Grizzly 2. And still more of you are probably thinking, I didn't know Grizzly 1 existed. And that's sad. You should really go and watch Grizzly. It's a William Girdler film. In the late 70s, this guy was the king of nature goes batshit flicks. He did it better than anybody. He made a film called Day of the Animals, in which climate change causes collusion between all the creatures of the forest, who then murder people left and right. And most notably, the greatest sequence in the film is one in which Leslie Nielsen is interrupted as he's raping a woman by a pissed off bear that proceeds to rip him apart. Once again, supporting my theory, bears hate rape. I've been saying this for years, and people have thought I was crazy.
All the best jokes about hunters disagree.
There you go.
You are here for the hunting, right?
Yeah, there you go. And Day of the Animals was actually the follow-up to Girdler's Grizzly, which, for my money, stands as one of the best Jaws ripoffs of all time. It's just, instead of a shark, let's just make it in the woods and make it a bear. Grizzly! And he did it so well, and it stars Christopher George, one of cinema's least fuckiest to give actors of all time. Like, every movie that Christopher George is in, whether it's City of the Living Dead, whether it's Grizzly, he has zero fucks to give.
You really think that Grizzly is better than Alien or Piranha?
I didn't say it was the best. I said it was one of the best.
Okay. We just need to clarify that. Because
also, the answer, my friend, is the car for the best Jaws ripoff of all time. And I will stand by that until the day that I die.
I will say that Alien's better.
That's fine. And most people would agree with you, whatever. But one of my favorite topics of discussion in any regard is lost and unfinished films. I don't know why that is exactly. I guess I'm just fascinated by the sort of like archaeological aspect of film appreciation that it represents.
Well, there's a certain train wreck quality of wondering what went wrong and how bad it went wrong. But then on top of that, there's also the unseen potential. You know, the movie we're going to talk about might have ended up being good.
There is
might have been decent, might have been watchable, might have had moments that we would reference when talking about other movies, but this movie was lost.
I contend that there is a decent movie in Grizzly 2. You just there's a lot to strip away, and there's a lot of things that are unfinished in this movie that I feel would have compensated for some of its lackings. But unfortunately, the only thing we see now in this work print are the shortcomings.
Well, we need to talk about that because yes. The thing is this movie exists, but it doesn't exist.
So where has Grizzly 2 been? So this is a story all about how the sequel got gypped and buried until now. So what happened was this film... It's a crazy story. So this work print of Grizzly 2 starts surfacing on the internet in 2007.
Well, this goes earlier than that.
No, it does. So when people started watching this work print, there becomes this interest that's developed. It's like, where has this movie been? Where did it come from? And it's got a bizarre story. In 1983, they begin production on the sequel, which, keep in mind, is a good 5 years after Girdler was killed in a helicopter accident in the Philippines. So already yeah,
it's a sequel to a 1976 movie. Yes. We're making a sequel 7 years after the movie has come out.
Yes.
And we're making Grizzly 2. Why? Grizzly 1 wasn't a huge smash hit, but for some reason they're doing it.
So they start shooting this movie on a Russian military base in Hungary, in Budapest.
An abandoned Russian military base.
And they owed so much money on this film, and they were unable to pay, largely due to the ambition that they were building this giant animatronic bear that they could never make work.
And also owing to the fact that one of the producers apparently ran off with a bunch of the money.
Which happens more often than you think. But because of these unpaid debts, the Hungarian government seizes the prints. These are ours.
And the equipment.
This is ours. All of this is ours now because you're filming in what is essentially at this time still the Soviet Union. We own all of this. We're taking it. So that was the end. Or most people think that's the end of the movie. But 4 years later, in ride the White Knights of Golan and Globus. And they buy the movie from the Hungarian government. And they're like, yes, we are going to finish this film. We are going to release it. And it's going to be great. And then they go bankrupt.
Yeah,
they lose their money, and once again, the film is buried. The film cannot get finished due to having absolutely no funding behind it.
It sits for 20 years, lost, forgotten, and many believed it to be a legend. People believed that this movie really didn't exist because it has a cast that there's no way this movie is out there with this cast and nobody's put it out, that nobody's seen it. And then and for years, people talk about that. And then in 2007, a work print shows up online.
It just, out of nowhere, it turns up online. And there's so many weird things about the movie itself. Okay, so I'm not going to lie. It's a completely doofy movie. I mean, the central premise...
Well, it's a work print that is a mess. No. And all work prints
are messes. It's not just the work print. The premise of the film is goofy as hell. It's the bear attacks a concert in the middle of a national forest... a concert of bands that are awful, which is strange because if you start thinking about different horror sequels, Jaws 2 hates teenagers, Troll 2 hates vegetarians, and Grizzly 2 apparently hates new wave music.
Well, Grizzly 2 hates everything. I mean, that's you just talked about that's the plot of the movie. That's the last 15 minutes of the movie. The bulk of the movie is Jaws with an 18-foot-tall grizzly.
Right.
And a cast of bizarro characters with strange motivations that get so absurd at times.
Well, yeah, and I mean, right down to the fact that Louise Fletcher is playing the administrator of the concert, who could not be more... waspy and rigid if she tried, and yet she's the administrator of this total new wave Bonnaroo in the middle of this national forest, and she becomes effectively the mayor character from Jaws.
Yeah, I need 12 good men. Give me 12 men.
You can't have them. But you get this job done with what you've got.
You have this park ranger. It's like, we have a 15-foot grizzly out there that's killing people, and she's just like, did it happen here or did it happen 10 miles away? Or happen 10 miles away? What, do you want me to shut down the park every time somebody dies?
But then the movie makes the weird choice to have a second mayor character by having the bleeding heart liberal who, even after the grizzly has killed four people,
Yeah.
For three teenagers, which we'll get to in a moment, and a poacher murdered them horrifically. She's still like, no. You're treating this bear like it's guilty, like it's done anything wrong. And it's like, motherfucker, it is killing people. And it's like, well, we can't kill it. We have to, you know, trank it and take it back out into the wild. And
let's all get on Ben Tramer's boat and go hunt this fucking thing.
Yeah, it is. And so you have these two characters that are ostensibly working against this one guy who's just getting cock-blocked at every angle while he's trying to, you know, he's like got 80,000 kids coming to this New Wave show and an 18-foot-tall grizzly running around mauling everybody. And he, nobody will fucking help him.
And it's almost as much Jaws the Revenge as it is Jaws, because in Jaws, it's really just a question of nature and the food chain and all this other stuff and who's the alpha predator, blah, 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 blah. In this movie, it all stems from the fact that one of the hunters kills the cub of this giant bear, and the bear is fucking pissed off. And the bear goes through the whole movie just taking people out, not to eat them, not to survive, but just because it's fucking pissed off.
Yeah, it's just, it's angry.
Yeah.
And so
angry.
So we end up having to resort to some way to stop this bear. So who do we get? Okay, so yeah, now let's, before we get here, let's enter the oeuvre of giant bear movies and talk about a little movie called Prophecy. Not the Prophecy.
There's an oeuvre for giant bear movies.
Except that there are. Because
no, there are. There's the Ursine oeuvre, I believe is what it's called.
So if you've ever seen Prophecy, Frankenheimer's mutant bear movie that came out the same summer as Alien, and is nowhere.
I just realized where you're going with this.
Oh yes, because in that movie we have Armand DeSante playing a Native American.
And what are you gonna do? I'm a Native American. What, you don't believe me? What, you don't believe me? I'm totally a Native American. It's fucking, how, motherfucker? How?
It is hilarious, and you think that it is probably one of the most offensive modern straight-faced attempts at a Native American character.
How can they possibly get any more offensive than Armand DeSante? John Rhys Davies.
Everybody's favorite dwarf that you're not allowed to throw.
And I'm at any given point during the movie, I'm still not convinced that he's not a French-Canadian fur trapper from the 19th century. Like, he's definitely playing a Native American, but I'm just like, Jean-Pierre? Like,
I'm pretty sure they say that he's not actually Native American, that he was somebody who just joined up with the Native Americans and started dressing like them. And acting like them and became this brilliant.
He's Marlon Brando.
It's so absurd and offensive. And he talks in this stilted, bad, you know,
F troop type Native
American. And it's just, it's like, what the fuck am I watching here?
You got a problem with a little grizzly, huh?
What is that? You got the devil there.
And this is one of those elements of the work print that may not have survived into the film, but they have a moment where we're being told about him. And so we cut to this black and white flashback of him telling a story over a campfire before we go and meet him. And I'm sure that probably wouldn't have survived because it's the perfect kind of no,
because the rest of the movie
here
is airtight.
No, there's some now. Now, there are a few good moments in that movie.
Of
like
course
you,
there
you
are.
Think there's some, you were saying before, you think there's a decent movie in there.
There is.
And that got me reflecting on several of the moments that I thought were really well done in the movie. But let's talk about one that wasn't first. Let's talk about John Rhys Davies.
Yeah.
As this Native American stereotype hunting, you know, this bear. And there's this great scene in which
Was this character created by James Fenimore Cooper? Is like, is he the last of the badly drawn Mohicans? Is that what's going on here?
Well, there's this great scene where the liberal of all people, you know, the bleeding heart liberal is just like, you know, when we can't hurt it, we can't hurt her. Is like, oh, well, there's claw marks 18 feet high. And he's just like, you silly girl, claw marks, you know, bears can climb trees and put the claw marks. What you need to talk about is how big the foot size is. And how far apart they are, and the gait, and then she goes and she just kind of lifts that out. You know, she just drops it all out. And he's like, oh yeah, it's 3 inch deep and packs oil and 8 feet across, you know, at the back, and his eyes grow wide. And he's like, it must be 18 feet tall. It's just like
foiled by math again.
And then he turns into one of the more ridiculous characters in the movie. For all the characters that are actually making sense and are, even the characters that aren't, that are kind of illogical, he's just kind of the weirdest one.
Yeah.
That then does battle with the bear at the end.
But John
in a very T.S. Quint sort of way.
Oh, sure. No, absolutely. And I think we just better run down the laundry list of people who are in this film.
So let's start with the namesake of this, our boy George.
Our boy George is definitely in this film. And he plays one of a trio of campers who early on in the film sort of, you know, they are a trio of the blonde chick from Jaws. There's this trio of campers that are just going out. Prior to the concert, they're going to go out and they're going to party out in the woods, whatever. So you got George Clooney, you have Charlie Sheen as the other dude, and Laura Dern as the girl.
Yeah. Now, you never, this being a work print, they don't have the inserts in yet. They don't have a lot of the close-ups. So it's mostly all long shots of them. We've got them camping through the woods. We've got voiceover of them doing their lines. You know, we've got them talking. And what they are is they're three people who are going to this concert and they've decided to hike through the forest. Mm-hmm. And they exist only within the first act because at the end of the first act, the 18-foot bear shows up and eats them. And horrifically drags them off and does terrible things. There's a scene in which...
It should be mentioned, that's all suggested because the other thing that's missing from this work print is anything even closely resembling violence.
Yes. Well, what's missing is the bear.
Right.
Because they had problems with the bear, with the animatronics, so they didn't get it to work. So they were going to mock it up later and put them in. And so wherever you'd see the bear, you get a black screen.
It's very fitting that a movie that is borrowing this heavily from Jaws can't get its own shark work.
I thought that was very apropos.
Yeah, Bruce the bear.
But so there's this. So in talking about this cast, there's this scene in which Laura Dern is doing a strip tease to George Clooney to seduce George Clooney before they screw, while Charlie Sheen is the chaste one going off into the hills to kind of hang out and let them screw. So it's
on so many levels.
It's odd on so many levels. And it's Charlie Sheen, when he's so young, he still sounds like his brother, Emilio. And you swear to God that it's Emilio Estevez and not Charlie Sheen until you see him in a well-lit shot and he starts sounding more like himself. And it's like, holy shit, this really is Charlie Sheen. But So those are the three. We've got John Rhys-Davies. And who else do we have in this thing?
As I mentioned before, Louise Fletcher kind of playing that mayor type character. You also have Charles Cyphers, who a lot of people might remember as the sheriff from Halloween, and Jack Starrett, who was in so many incredible and even is responsible for making some incredible exploitation films, but most notably was sort of the sheriff in First Blood. So it's funny, you have sheriffs from two completely different film franchises coming together and playing poachers.
And then we've got that girl who all throughout the early 80s played the hot daughter.
Yes.
In movies like Real Genius.
Deborah Raffin.
Yeah, and it is that, yes,
Deborah Raffin.
Oh, okay. I for some reason I thought her name was Morgan. For some reason, I don't know why.
She was also in Death Wish 3. I love Death Wish 3
yeah,
so
you
much.
Do.
Oh my God, Charles Bronson, urban renewal, motherfucker.
she's
in The Sentinel. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, and she was, you know, she was that played the young hot daughter and everything for a short spell, and it's such a weird. Good cast for this kind of movie. And the poachers, we haven't even mentioned the poachers yet because the poachers makes almost no goddamn sense.
Jack Starrett and Charles Cyphers are two of the poachers.
No, I know that. But what I'm saying is
those
audience who has not seen this movie,
I keep
poachers.
That there's no way anybody could. Actually, I believe the actress you're thinking of is Deborah Foreman, who was in things like April Fool's Day and,
yes,
like you said, Real Genius. That's the one you're thinking of.
Yes, that's who I was thinking of.
Yeah.
She's the one who has that great line in Real Genius, you know, can you hammer a 9-inch spike through a piece of wood with your penis? Well, not right now. I love Real Genius. But so it's this weird cast. The poachers.
Yeah.
There is this beeline subplot that has almost no connection with the rest of the movie that only tangentially keeps crossing every once in a while. The first victim of the grizzly is a poacher. And
the one that killed the cub.
Yeah, the one that he killed the cub. He gets killed and his friend escapes. the brother of the dead one wants to get revenge on his partner because he thinks that's what did it. And he's like, no, I'm telling you, this thing, it's huge. It's got to be 18 foot tall. Everybody knows exactly how tall this thing is. And then they come up with this, they pull this magical number out of their ass that this thing must be worth $100,000. And oh my God, between the four of us, that's $25,000 each. Let's go do it for the $25,000.
Like, do they look in the Kelly Blue Book of Bears, the Kelly Bear Book.
They just
book,
pull the number out of their ass. And so for the rest of the movie, they're always talking about their $25,000. It's absurd. But
did that Kittner woman put a bounty on the bear? What is going on here?
But they're constantly going through the woods, setting up all these traps and setting up all these things. And really, what this movie feels like is they wanted to make a sequel. They knew they wanted the bear to terrorize this rock concert at the end. Knew that there was that was going to be so expensive, so they needed to pad this movie out. So they padded out with every fucking subplot imaginable. So we've got time. You know, we mentioned Clooney and Dern and Sheen, and they're in like 5, 6, 7 solid minutes of the movie before they die. They're in, their death is the end of the first act, essentially. And and we keep going back and spending time with them. And it's like, why are we spending any time with these guys? And then they die. And then we spend time with the poachers. And the poachers end up, offing each other in various ways. And, like, there's all this weird shit going on.
They become, like, the Keystone Cops meet Deliverance. Like, they're a very weird quartet.
And with one of the guys looking like the Hound.
Yeah,
exactly. One of the actors looks exactly like the Hound.
And we haven't even talked about this goddamn concert.
No.
It smacks of a really old film producer going, you know what kids like? Musical concerts. Let's make the centerpiece of our giant killer bear movie a musical concert. And somebody went, sir, we can't really afford to staff like enough extras to make it look like a big rock concert. What are we going to do?
Nazareth.
So they find out that Nazareth is playing a concert in Hungary near where they're filming. And decide they're going to wait till Nazareth stops playing and then just go film the audience just lollygagging around after the concert and then push one of their own, like, groups of actors on stage and be like, this is a band. And the people in the audience had no idea, one, it was a fake band, and two, that they were even being filmed.
There's actually a great shot in the print in which one guy turns around and looks at the camera with this big goofy grin on his face, and then he says something, and everyone else in the audience starts turning around and looking into the camera because they're like, he said, holy shit, we're being filmed in Hungarian. And so everybody turns around, they're like, oh my God, we're being filmed. And so there's this shot in the movie that would never, I would hope, never make it to the big screen, although kind of part of me wishes it does, because I'd love to see that in a finished movie because it's just every bit as absurd as so much of the other stuff going on in the film. But I know that's the kind of work print stuff where it's like, okay, we've got a couple shots like this, but this shot works for the time being.
Thank God for Nazareth.
But the bands.
It's something no one has ever seen.
The bands in this movie are so bad.
As far as like, now, keep in mind, I have to speculate on some of this because it's a work print. There's not a lot of information out there, but I do know for a fact that one of the bands was a real girl group, one-hit wonder, called Toto Coelho. And they do this awful fucking song.
Oh, shit. Movie. Now that you mention the name, because I didn't see the name before.
Well, I had to look it up.
I know their song.
Here's what I had to do.
I have it on a Night Flight collection.
Oh, God. I had to look it up by the lyrics. I went to Google and I looked up the lyrics and found this group and looked at the history of them. They were a very early sort of one of those experiments by one rich white dude to put, a group together to sell records. They were just this pop runoff. But they had this song in the movie that's just like, you take the milk from the coconut.
Repeated over and over again for 5 minutes.
And apparently their big hit in the 80s was I Eat Cannibals. So they were an actual real group. Now, I did the same thing with all of the, like, there's like two other bands / artists that play during the movie. So I tried doing the same thing, kind of sort of like retconning their lyrics and couldn't find anything about them. So I'm thinking those are the ones that were just kind of made up for the movie. But what's really weird is early on in the film when they're setting up the stage for the concert, as everyone's rehearsing and stretching and dancing, They're playing the entire Thriller album.
Yes.
Because it's a work print, because they knew they were going to dub over it and didn't have to worry about the rights.
Because it was in 1983, and in 1983, that was the biggest selling album in the world, and everybody was listening to Thriller. And you can actually hear it in the background of Wild Sound throughout the thing, mm-hmm. where they're like, hey, everybody's working out, so we're going to just play, and they play Thriller, because yeah. everybody was fucking listening to Thriller, so everybody would fucking work out to Thriller.
But I remember my brother actually came over today while I was watching this work print and goes, wow, they could afford Michael Jackson? And I was like, nope.
Yeah, and that second band, I mean, they're bad enough, but that second band is equally terrible.
Like that one almost like Human League sounding guy that's just like dragging the intern, who, by the way, is in the movie for no fucking reason whatsoever. Like this, like, oh, gee whiz, I get to work in the concert and build stuff and get donuts and yay.
Well, I mean, the reason she's there is twofold. They had, again, I think she's one of those filler storylines. Because they actually
go with the eight other filler storylines there.
Yeah, but you know, it's an hour and a half movie for a work print, and a work print to be at a nice lean 97 minutes is a problem. She's also there because she's the daughter of the park ranger that is essentially our Chief Brody, who's running very around trying to stop this. And he, you know, it's the pathos of, oh my God, you know, my daughter's there. I have to stop this thing.
This bear that he has been screaming from the rafters is going to kill people and is dangerous, goes after 100,000 people at this concert. But thankfully, there's his daughter's there, so he will care whether or not it kills everyone.
Well, no. It's so that we know why, you know, his personal stake. Mm. And yes, no, it's definitely ham-fisted. But that actually, her storyline actually has the one really great character moment in the movie where, you know, she's having this flirtation with this new wave guy who's supposed to be a big deal. You know, Rolling Stone wants to talk to him and People wants to talk to him, but he's making time to talk with her and flirt with her and things are going well. And they have this little thing later where he comes to her and he just kind of explains to her, hey, you know, the thing about this, you know, this career, you know, you just kind of do things on a lark. You do them as a, you know, for a laugh, you know, as a joke. She goes, is that what I am? I'm a lark. I'm a laugh. I'm a joke.
And then a giant killer lark comes down from the sky.
And then he goes, yeah. And you realize that, you know, she has that profound moment where she's just like, oh shit, I'm just the flavor of the day. I'm, you know, I'm nothing special to him. She's like, oh, okay. And she turns, she goes away. And that's her big emotional. And it's this really cool kind of weird growing pains moment in this movie. Then right before all the, you know, the bear carnage begins.
And it's funny too, because we talked about this animatronic bear that they were trying to put together and they were trying to make work. And again, this is why I believe there would have been an interesting movie here, or a decent movie at the very least. The ambition behind this giant bear, when you do actually see it a couple of times in this big, very unfinished, very rough climax that they shot. You see it kind of over the shoulder shot. You see like maybe a paw. You see this really weird shot of John Rhys Davies leaping and grabbing onto it and stabbing it repeatedly. But then at the end of the film, right before, I would say the credits roll, but right before it just goes black because they hadn't finished it, there were no credits, we see it sort of entangled in the lighting system of the stage after it's been killed, and it is massive and it is terrifying.
Yeah, it's really kind of fucking cool looking.
It's brilliant.
Like the moment I see that, I was like, holy shit, that thing actually looks cool. Like so much of this movie's been goofy, and this thing,
yeah.
You know, they electrocute it, you know, because they decide to go the Jaws 2 route. Because exactly. You know, they'd already ripped off Jaws with the first one. Ripping off Jaws 2 by electrocuting it at the end is the clear way to go. But you see this thing tangled up, and it really does look cool. And what's funny is that, again, more work print issues. If you watch, you see members of the crowd who are there for this other concert run up to get their picture taken with the bear.
Yeah.
Like in the shot, you see them running towards it and like posing really quick to get a quick shot of them with this fucking crazy bear, which I'm sure there's probably all throughout Hungary, there's probably, you know, 30-year-old photo albums with pictures of them with this bear from this movie that they swear they were in, but nobody has ever seen or heard of.
But luckily, the Return of the Killer Tomatoes SAG representative is there to be like, yes, you were in it and you have to be paid. But that's the thing, is that not only are they running up to get their picture taken with it, but because it's just kind of the ambient sound, there's no cheering, there's no screaming. It's just very like nobody knows what's going on. It's just people milling about. Yep. So it's just kind of this general murmur as this giant fuck-off bear is dead on stage.
What was weird is I heard that this was a work print, and when I watched it, for the first hour and 15 minutes, I'm like, this isn't so much a work print as it is, you know, just somebody's rough cut. I don't know why they call it a work print. I mean, it's missing shots, but most of these shots are finished. Yeah, there aren't inserts, but that's, it's entirely possible that I thought, yeah, it's entirely possible they're on a low budget and they hadn't, you know, they hadn't shot any. But then you get to the third act. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes work printy as hell. You start hearing people call out directions. You know,
action a lot during the, like the pyrotechnic stuff.
There's a scene in which they race in with a Jeep, and the Jeep makes a little jump, and some of the jumps it makes, some of it doesn't. You watch six different angles of that same jump, not in a Michael Bay slow motion isn't this cool way. It's here's all the takes we have of that. There's one take of one of the characters hiding behind something that we see three takes of. All of a sudden it starts to become a mess of a work print.
Yeah.
And you start to see all of the weirdness that you get in a work print. You get entire takes with that are clearly off of dailies that they haven't finished processing yet. It's got no sound.
Well, not only that, but you can see where the bear was going to play the biggest role, because all of a sudden there's all of these little insert, just shots of black, and that's where the bear was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And you can see exactly the, you know, how much we were going to see the bear in that climax.
Which you, in a true Jaws fashion, in a true low budget fashion, we see the bear maybe 3, 4, 5 times in the first hour.
Right.
Tops. And it's hinted that we probably wouldn't see it all. But, here at the end, the bear's all over the place. It's black screen in between lots of stuff.
Yeah.
And he's fighting John Rhys-Davies. There's a great moment where John Rhys-Davies jumps onto this big, like, fur-covered something or other that's supposed to be the 18-foot tall thing.
It looks like he's trying to kill the keyboardist from Rockafire Explosion.
It looks like he's trying to kill a curtain.
Yeah,
he's jumped onto this curtain, and he's stabbing this curtain before he gets blasted off and impaled on something.
Yeah.
And it's really... And it's weird, too, because we see him die twice at two different points in the movie. Because, again, work print, and they haven't quite figured out where that's... So all of a sudden, you watch John Rhys-Davies die.
That's
like,
right.
Oh, he got killed quick. Why did they even bring him in? And then it's like, oh, then we see him running around later. And it's, yeah, it's like, oh, I guess he's better now. Oh, wait, no, he just got killed and impaled with the same thing we saw.
This is his twin brother who also decided for some reason to go live amongst the Native Americans and develop a bad accent. So... They shared that trait, the two brothers, the two Rhys-Davieses. But yeah, that's
Davies plural.
Davies plural. That's Grizzly 2, which I realize a lot of you are like, this is not a movie that people have really seen.
It's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube.
And there are completed work print versions floating around, because that's how we saw one.
Yeah.
And we just got past one.
Yeah.
And there's no other way to see this. There may never be. You know, people have talked about trying to put it back together.
There's really no point. I don't feel like. I mean, how could you possibly do it without making it look like a Sci-Fi Channel film?
How you could do it is if somebody really, really was really into it and spent, you know, 6 months in their garage building a perfectly working animatronic bear and shooting the bear shots.
Don't film it in Hungary.
Don't film it in Hungary. But no, but you, I mean, if there was someone out there crazy enough to do that, to shoot those shots and put it together, and I'm sure you can probably get the rights to that footage for a song, how much of it exists. Like, that work print may be the only thing that exists left. Like, everything else could have been destroyed, could be sitting in film cans that, you know, have gone bad over time and have the ammonia smell.
Yeah.
Or they could be perfectly intact on a shelf somewhere in, you know, one of the studios as part of one of those deals, and could just be stumbled upon and like, hey, we could actually assemble a good looking print of this if only we had the bear shots and somebody shooting it so it looked period appropriate.
I think those are called honey shots. I think when you're talking about the missing scenes with the bears that really bring, I'm just saying.
No.
When you're talking about a bear climax, you're talking about a honey shot.
No.
Yes.
No. No. And you did that in two different ways.
Yes,
and
I did.
That was a double penetration joke, and I'm not a double penetration.
I think it's called a double Paddington when you're talking about bears. Double
Paddington.
DP.
Oh.
But yeah, that's our sort of kind of ode to George Clooney. Just derailed into a discussion of Grizzly 2.
Well, I mean, we knew that was going to happen. But and somewhere out there, George Clooney is not listening to this and doing something interesting with his life, like, you know, buying satellite time to help save Africans, or flying in to deliver food without telling anybody that he's doing it, or dressing up as Batman and crying himself to sleep over, you know. I'll tell the one story that I've heard that I love is that he doesn't keep any memorabilia of any of his movies, that he's not big into showing off all the things he's done. The only thing he keeps is, apparently on his desk, he keeps a picture of him in the Batman suit to remind him of what, you know, when you don't trust your gut instinct and what can happen. And that's the one thing he's kept from the movies, is a picture of him as Batman, and that's it. And I hope that's true. I've got that on a good, from a good source. So I really hope that's true, because that's the George Clooney I want to be living in this world.
If you don't trust your gut instinct, at least trust your nipple instinct, because that is going to steer you in the correct path every single time.
I'm Batman.
And for this week's junk food pairing, why not enjoy a delicious Pepsi Cola? It's the choice of a new generation.
Or perhaps... See, there we go. There's a junk food pairing that goes all the way back to earlier. That's what we call a callback, folks.
And if you're hungry, Nestle Crunch satisfies.
Or a Moosehead from the north.
From the north. Or a Foster's
from the south.
Really? This is like deep, deep,
I love south. That movie so much. God, I love Return of the Killer Tomatoes. Oh, if you've not seen Return of the Killer Tomatoes, if there's one movie from tonight you really need to seek out and watch for your own true, honest-to-God enjoyment, get a couple friends together and watch Return of the Killer Tomatoes. If you get a chance, track down Grizzly 2, because it's great from a film history aspect. It really is kind of it is so deeply in its period. And what flaws it has, you can enjoy. And you can enjoy the sheer delicious weirdness of it. And what moments in their work and the performance things that work do actually work. So there's some real stuff to check out.
I'm Batman.
And that's going to do it for this week's Junk Food Cinema. We hope you have enjoyed. Please do follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. You can also find us individually online. I am at Bri Guy Salisbury. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/Brian Salisbury Critic. How about you, Cargill?
I am at Massaworm, MassaWyrm, on Twitter, and facebook.com/Massaworm. And you can find my new book, Queen of the Dark Things, in bookstores wherever you buy books.
And yeah, and once again, we'll have the Amazon links here on the page for everything. I would hazard everything but Grizzly 2, which is not currently...
You can't find anything Grizzly 2, but there's something else we should probably mention.
That is right. Coming up this July 4th, we are going to be in Minneapolis, Minnesota for Convergence.
Convergence, baby.
Which is...
I'm a guest of honor this year, and we'll be doing Junk Food Cinema Live there. So for those of you that can't make it, we will be doing an episode from Convergence.
Yeah, well, actually, I think we're going to be doing that live, so you'll actually be able to hear us as we're recording it, which will be a lot of fun. But yeah, we are taking this act on the road. Yeah. Hopefully people won't throw tomatoes at us, but if they're killer tomatoes.
The return of the killer tomatoes.
And we're going to go ahead and wrap this episode up. Please continue to find us on iTunes and Stitcher and all that good stuff. And I just want to end this episode by saying sincerest apologies to George Clooney.
I'm not going to apologize to Clooney. I think Clooney owns this stuff. And I think Clooney, you know, you see him in these movies, you see him working hard and who he became. He's that classic jobber who would take any gig he could to get on the movie screen, and it paid off. So, you know, I this was not making fun of him, I don't believe. I went into this wanting to celebrate him and his early work and the stuff that he accomplished when he was a nobody, that shows just how talented he was to carry through a 30-year career.
And let's be real, I think the guy still owes us an apology for Batman and Robin.